Welcome to Rewilding Love. This season is with a couple on the brink of divorce.
This is episode 49, an interview with Alvin Dawkins.
The essence or the core of who you really are has never been abandoned, has never been left.
Nothing can separate us from the love of God.
For many years, I battled and struggled with depression, at times severe and crippling. Low self-esteem, self-loathing, self-sabotaging behaviors, distorted and self-limiting beliefs.
We may have our preferences about what we like and what we don't like about the human experience, but I see it as all being for us and all part of that growth and expansion and learning.
There is nothing that separates us from this love because love is all there is. There's nothing apart from that.
The entire human experience is an expression of that life force.
This term psychology, in its essence, breaks itself down to, I think it's Greek, and the root word is psyche, which means soul.
It is us, and we don't need anyone or anything to access it. We all have an equal accessibility.
I'm writing this book to point to the truth of who you really are. It's time to open up the prison cell door and free yourself.
You are listening to Rewilding Love with me, Angus Ross.
And me, Rohini Ross.
Rewilding Love is a podcast about relationships.
We believe that love never disappears completely in relationships. It can always be rewilded.
Relax and enjoy the show.
We are very grateful to have Alvin Dawkins as our guest today on our podcast. And Alvin is a Rewilder guide. He's also a jazz bassist, composer, songwriter, and recording artist. And he's author of the forthcoming book, From Prison to Purpose, which is a memoir that chronicles his birth in prison and being adopted and growing up in Alabama during the ugliness of Jim Crow segregation, during the heart of the civil rights movement.
On top of all this, Alvin found himself struggling with severe and oftentimes debilitating depression that thankfully ultimately led to a series of spiritual insights that offered him a pathway out of that suffering.
And because of his insights, Alvin is now able to help others who are dealing with depression and anxiety and really point them in the direction of what helped him to experience freedom and more peace of mind. What I thought Alvin expressed so beautifully and clearly in this episode is how it was that deeper innate intelligence within him that helped him to navigate those challenges and actually find a way to live a bigger and freer life.
Yeah, I always remember a client of mine at some point saying how he wanted to develop more rapport with that part of himself that we might refer to as soul or the intelligence behind life, wisdom. And I feel like that was a journey that Alvin has been on. I guess we're all on that journey, but Alvin is very good at articulating that journey. And I'm imagining that's going to be the essence of the book, which I can't wait to read.
Yeah, and I think about how there are those moments in life where it's really clear that we're listening to that deeper wisdom. And then at other times, it looks like we're not really being guided by it. But actually, it's the impetus behind all of our behavior and actions that we're always coming from that divine energy expressing through us. Sometimes we're just more consciously aware of it and or not.
Well, again, yeah, I think it's the sort of push and pull story between our personal mind, which is quite often just a set of rules that's been instilled in our heads. And then there's the impersonal mind, which is always going to offer us a pathway towards what is personally true and meaningful. And it kind of, you know, when I use that term or that client used that term rapport, for me, it is developing rapport with that part of ourselves. And I think it is listening to that voice, that feeling, whatever that prompt is to follow that path.
Yeah. And it's often the case that we don't even realize sometimes how that wisdom is playing out and how we're listening to that intuition, because it's often not a straight line.
Yes, I guess quite often not a straight line. And maybe it's even quite higgledy-piggledy on occasion.
Well, I'm remembering specifically if I had this really strong intuition when I was 17 and everybody was graduating from high school, and I lived in this very small rural town where maybe three people went to high school out of the whole, I mean, went to college out of the whole graduating class. I don't think that's exaggerating. Like, not very many people went to college. And I decided that I didn't want to go to college in Canada, that I was going to go to university in France, and that I worked at this restaurant that was owned by a French woman and her Canadian husband. And he had done that. He went to France. I think he did his PhD in France. And so he told me about it, and that sort of planted the seed in my mind. And so he told, when I mentioned that I was thinking of doing that, he said, yeah, you just go, you sign up, and it's amazing. It's a wonderful opportunity. And it was either very inexpensive or free. I can't quite remember at the time. And so I decided I'm going to go and go to school in France. And so from his telling me what to do, I didn't do any preparation ahead of time. I didn't know where I was going to live. I didn't sign up with university. I just went to France. I went via some other countries on the way, visited family, and I had a boyfriend in tow for part of the time. But then he left, and the university's starting up, and I go to the university to sign up. And that was the first year that they decided that all foreign students needed to pass a foreign language exam the February before the next academic year. So I'm there in September signing up, finding out for the first time that I was supposed to have written a test in February to prove that I could speak French.
My goodness.
And so I wasn't allowed to go to university. And of course, everything was hinging on that, because once I got into university, I'd be able to live in the university dorms, and I'd be able to sign up for the university meal plan, and I'd be going to school there. It was all going to be set. So now, not only was I not in school, and I didn't have anywhere to live, and I didn't have a lot of money at that point in time. And so I can't even remember how it happened, but at some point, I was sort of talking to friends that I'd met there, and someone said, you know what, I'm going up to Paris. He was doing his dissertation, and he had to go and do research up in Paris. And he said, so my room's going to be empty. If you want to rent my room for me, you can rent my room. Mm. And so I'm like, oh, so I got to stay in his room. And then, and I can't remember, I think it came with his meal plan or something. I managed to eat at the university cafeteria. And then I'm like, well, what am I going to do here for a year if I can't go to college? And so I just decided that I would try and go and do a year at a French high school, because I was still only 17. Mm. And so I found this French lycée, and I decided to just go and talk to the director and see if he'd let me in. So I went and met with the director, Monsieur Lagrange, I remember him. And what was so funny about him is that when I went in there, he was speaking to me in English, and he had this booming American accent. Really? Like, it was like he sounded like a Texan to me.
Yeah, but he was French.
He was French, but he'd studied in Texas. So he had this like amazing American accent. And he said yes. He said that I could study there for a year, and I did. So he put me into a language studies curriculum. It was the Premier A curriculum, which was a lot of focus on languages. And so I just integrated into their class.
Amazing.
I know.
And did you find yourself making friends with the other students? Were they obviously of a similar
age?
Yeah,
I had really, they all thought I was like really interesting, because I was from, you know, another country, and I was just this, I think they'd been together for a long time. And I'm just remembering, before I got to renting the room in the university, there was a period of time where I had nowhere to stay. And one of the friends that I met when I was traveling, her boyfriend, she had a French boyfriend who owned this judo gym. And so she said that I could sleep in the judo gym at night when it was not being used because there were showers and things like that. And I had to leave in the morning.
And you did that.
I did that. And I remember sleeping on the ground on this mat and reading some terribly depressing, I think it was a Farewell to Arms Hemingway book that is so depressing. I remember crying pretty much every night.
Oh, no.
And but it luckily it didn't go on for too long until I met this other gentleman that was running out his room.
Fantastic.
But then, you know, I get to, you know, do this amazing program, and then, well, you probably don't want to hear this part, but I was getting my hair cut one day and the hairdresser like took forever to cut my hair. It took like 2 hours to cut my hair, and then it turns out that he was waiting to ask me out. That's why it took so long to cut my hair. And so then we ended up dating, and you know, I had this whirlwind
romance.
French romance.
My goodness,
that was
me.
Amazing.
And then you came back to the state. I came back to Canada after that.
Well, then so I did my studies there. And then I guess, I don't know, my mom had convinced me to apply for some scholarships in Canada. And I got a scholarship to Queen's in Canada, which is a university. And so I remember my mom taught, because I would call her on Sundays, and she said, you got this letter and you've been accepted into Queen's University. And at this time, I was dating the French boy. I think I was living with the French boyfriend who was significantly older than me, which I think was completely freaking her out. And she's saying, I really think you should consider accepting this offer, because I think she was afraid that I was just going to, you know, end up marrying this guy, because it was a pretty nice life. We would on weekends to Saint-Tropez, and, you know, it was fun.
The high life.
It was fun. And we'd go snorkeling in the Mediterranean. But again, I listened to my gut and it said, yeah, go to Queen's. And so I left all that behind and ended up going to college in Canada.
Fantastic. What a good story. You know, it makes me think of a time when I think I was 20, and I had this strong gut sense that I wanted to, and I'd heard about this from someone I had met, to go on a kibbutz. And I actually went to some office in London to sign up for it, signed on the dotted line. I was ready to go. And I literally, there was a bus a coach that was going to drive out there, you know, go across on the ferry and then find its way up to Israel. And I had just missed a coach, and the next one was going to be in 3 weeks' time. But I'd signed up for it and paid for everything. And then I got a job in between and ended up doing the job. I thought, I should probably just get on the hamster wheel and start working. But I so regret doing that. I know that it would have been such a venture. So good for you for following your instincts and having the resolve to do exactly that at a tender age.
Yes. And I had my wallet stolen in Paris. So I lost pretty much all my money too. That was why I had no money.
Yeah. And that just sort of then probably catapulted you into one adventure after the other.
I guess so.
And now you have a story to tell.
My life has been a lot like that in terms of little intuitions guiding the way.
You're quite the traveler. Well, I guess we should let Alvin tell his story. What do you think?
Yes, absolutely. Let's turn it over to Alvin. Alvin, thank you so much for being with us today. We're really looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've only had brief moments where I've come into your orbit, but they've always been things that I have really, you know, it's always been a time that I've always really enjoyed, and Rohini has had nothing but good things to say about you. So I'm really happy that we get a chance to sit down and chat for, I don't know, an hour or so, or whatever it will be.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it as well, guys. And hopefully I can live up to the Rohini legend. <about me. laughs>
No pressure, Alvin.
No pressure at all.
So I've been in conversation with you, and I know that you're in the process of completing your book, which is forthcoming. And so I thought it would be really wonderful for our listeners to hear about your journey and to gain some insight in terms of how that has unfolded, what you have seen for yourself around your well-being, around peace of mind, around healing and growth, and then how rewilding has sort of been part of that journey for you. But we're happy to start wherever you'd like to start.
Sure, that's a great place, isn't it, to start. I'll just say that for me, this project started as my second year project at USM, the second year project that we all did at that time. And I decided to write a book. Now I'm a musician, and I've been a recording musician and touring and all of that for several years. And I felt in my heart that I wanted to do something that I hadn't done before. So I decided to write a book. And the title of the book is From Prison to Purpose. It chronicles pretty much my life from having been born in prison and then adopted some several months later into the family that raised me. I grew up here in Alabama in the Deep South during the period of, you know, a lot of racial strife and unrest, the civil rights movement, and all of that. Went to segregated schools, all of that. So I talk about those things in the book, the birth in prison, the adoption, and the issues that I struggled with around adoption for a long time, major depression that goes back to early childhood, even just memories of that, as well as fast forwarding, deciding to pursue my passion for music, which is something that I discovered very, very early on as a child, that has had this intense passion and love for music, while at the same time growing up in a very devoutly religious family and environment that didn't encourage the kind of music that I was interested in pursuing, namely, you know, rock and roll and R&B and jazz and all of that. And I struggled, just, you know, the struggles of navigating all of that. Then deciding to move to Austin, Texas, as a young adult to pursue my love for music. And in moving to Austin, it just opened up so many things for me, professionally, certainly spiritually. So I talk about that as well in the book.
Yeah. Right. And so in terms of that journey, I mean, that's quite a breadth of time. There's a lot of different elements to it. What are some of the key themes that you think would be important for the readers of the book to be aware of, but also for our listeners who hopefully will eventually read the book? What do you think are important themes for them to be aware of based on what you're sharing?
One major theme that threads throughout the book, if you will, is the idea, and I came to this much later. I didn't know this at the time, but this knowing that in spite of all of our experiences or traumas or whatever there is, there's this intelligence that's guiding all of this, that's guiding us. And we're connected to that intelligence. We're not separate from it. We're a part of it. Which also means that we have this innate wisdom, this innate intelligence, although a lot of times it doesn't seem like it or certainly doesn't feel like it, but we have this innate intelligence and wisdom that's protecting us and guiding us at the same time. Maybe I can share a bit more about that. I thought about maybe reading the introduction. Introduction to the book at some point that kind of gives a summary of what the reader will experience. Hopefully the reader will experience in reading the book.
Okay. Do you want to do that now?
Sure. I can do that.
Okay.
First off, I'll say that this is very tentative. This is just a rough.
We're getting a sneak peek.
Yeah. A sneak peek. Yeah.
A VIP preview.
Exactly. A private reading.
Yes.
I was born in prison, November 1957. My mother was an inmate at the Julia Tutwiler Prison for Women in Wetumpka, Alabama. Upon my birth, I was immediately taken from her and whisked away. never again to hear the familiar voice I had grown accustomed to growing inside her womb for the past several months, never to be touched or held by her, never to feel my naked skin against the warmth of her body, never to nurse at her breast for the much needed sustenance and physical bonding connection that my brand new body and my soul required, and that her body and nature had been skillfully preparing her over the months for just that. Never to meet the smile in her eyes to introduce and welcome me to a new and foreign world. For the next 10 months of my life, and until I was adopted into a loving and stable family, I have no idea where or how I spent those first crucial, important months. Did I live with a foster family? Maybe a series of temporary placements? I don't know. I know these things now because my birth mother shared this with me when she and I finally met over 35 years later, and we looked into each other's eyes for the very first time. Now, while I didn't always know that my life began in prison, I wouldn't discover this until many years later when I began to search for my birth mother. I had instead created many of my own prisons, mental prisons, emotional, psychological, and including religious, spiritual prisons that kept me bound with feelings of inadequacy, fears of abandonment, feelings of unworthiness, believing myself to be both unloved and unlovable, feelings of self-loathing, depression, and despondency, as well as fears of being heard and seen. Might these feelings have been, at least partly, the result of being immediately separated from my mother at birth? What about any mental, psychological, and spiritual traumas due to spending my entire prenatal development in prison? There are plenty of current studies that speak to how environment might negatively impact in utero development. What about my biological mom's own emotional, mental, and spiritual states as a pregnant inmate? Now take a moment to sit with and allow all of this to fully sink in, because this one singular event would set the course and define my life for many years to come, although it would take still many years to discover the why. You see, because in spite of growing up in a Christian home with a mother who held a devout belief and trust in God and the power of prayer, a faith I also adopted, but yet there lurked beneath the surface some unconscious lack of trust in God. After all, how could I trust in a God who allowed me to be permanently separated from my biological mother? Maybe God might abandon me too. Maybe he already had. As a young child, I felt drawn to and had a great passion for music. Whether it was rock and roll, country, jazz, or R&B, I loved it all. However, growing up in a very religious home, my interest in the devil's music, as it was called back then, wasn't encouraged. I was often told that listening to this music would send me to hell. I struggled with this. In fact, I was confused. Why would God give me such a deep love for music and then banish me to eternal punishment for it? I also grew up during Jim Crow racial segregation, legalized apartheid, and in the midst of the civil rights movement. I remember the Birmingham church bombing, which killed four little black girls, the murders in Mississippi of three civil rights workers, Chaney Goodman and Schwerner. I clearly remember Alabama Governor George Wallace standing in the doorway to prevent two black students from enrolling at the University of Alabama, the bloody Sunday march from Selma to Montgomery for black people's voting rights, all of the televised lunch counter sit-ins, black protesters beaten with police billy clubs, high-pressure fire hoses, and German Shepherd attack dogs. So why am I writing this book? For many years, I battled and struggled with depression, at times severe and crippling. Low self-esteem, self-loathing, self-sabotaging behaviors, distorted and self-limiting beliefs. Through my journey in finding freedom from depression and including freeing myself from my many internal prisons, I then realized so many are still trapped living in their own prisons, not living fully realized, authentic lives of joy, passion, fun, and heartfelt meaning. I'm writing to encourage and show you how it's possible for you to break out of yours. Saying this more emphatically, I'm writing this book to point to the truth of who you really are. It's time to open up the prison cell door and free yourself.
That's beautiful, Alvin.
Yeah, it's stunning.
Really beautiful, so well written, so impactful. I'm waiting for more.
I know. I was kind of feeling a little sad that you had to stop. But
yeah.
Really.
Yeah. No, I definitely like, okay, what's in the next chapter? I want to keep reading. So that, I mean, that introduction does such a beautiful overview of all of those really powerful influencers that would have impacted you growing up. And you point so clearly to how you have found your way out of that prison of depression, out of the pain resulting from racism. And that doesn't mean that that's not still present in life and in the world, and that I know you do a lot of work and activism in addressing that, but to free yourself from that inner suffering so that you're not carrying that inner burden. And I'm wondering, you know, you said that there's this intelligence within us. How has that been helpful to you in terms of your healing and in terms of freeing yourself?
Well, going back to my childhood, I would say that it was the family that I was raised in, because I was raised in a very loving Christian home, very active in my church, and that there was something in the messages that I heard there as a kid and as a teenager that really resonated with me. At the same time, it was the messaging that I heard in Dr. King's speaking and in his books. It was something that I resonated with and that I gravitated to, that that in spite of all of the ugliness and the meanness and all of the stuff that's going on out there, that there's something inside of us, inside of me, inside of all of us, that governs, that sustains me. In my church, they called it, you know, faith or trust or belief in God. Also for me, Rohini and Angus, I think there's something that I felt in the music as a kid, because how to say it, there was something about the music that allowed me to skate, to get out of my head, if you will, that it would take me to places in my imagination and away from, you know, the environment, that the things that was going on around me. In spite of the messaging that I was hearing from the church and from my parents about rock and roll, there was something else that I saw and felt in the music that was pure. And I saw it in the musicians, particularly on the West Coast, when they talked about peace and love and things like that, that there's some element in the music that frees me. I feel freedom when I'm hearing melody, you know, whether it's instrumental music or it's the music of the Beatles or whoever that is, that there's some element that allows me to get out of my head, to get out of my thinking. And it was one of the things that made me know as a child that I wanted to be a musician. And it was that thing. And the fact that there were screaming girls too. but when I moved to Austin, Texas in the mid 80s and started working as a professional musician, at the same time, I started having a series of spiritual experiences, if you will. And the short of that is I came to this unmistakable, just very powerful knowing who I really was, and that it had nothing to do with the color of my skin, that it had nothing to do with me having been separated from my biological mom or that I was adopted. Now, I came to that realization sometime later after the experiences. All of this didn't happen or download at the same time. But after those series of experiences, I started having these other insights, these other awakenings that, oh, the truth, Alvin, that the essence or the core of who you really are has never been abandoned, has never been left, you know, because there was the fear, even though as a kid and as a teenager in church, that God might leave me, God might abandon me, or I might do something that was displeasing to God. But that's not only not true, that's not possible, because we're a part of that. So that when the scripture says that nothing can separate us from the love of God, I know what that means on a very fundamental level, is that yes, there is nothing that separates us from this love, because love is all there is. There's nothing apart from that.
That's really powerful and profound and true in my experience as well.
Yeah, nothing can separate us from the love of God. And I love that that's in the scripture. And there is so much depth to that statement. And I'm sure that, you know, that never really landed for me in any kind of conscious way when I went to church with my mom as a kid, you know. So those are some of the statements in the Bible that just really, to me, point in a direction and give me such clarity. Now, I guess, with a little bit of this understanding under my belt, about what it all boils down to, which is, you know, that love, that intelligence, which is, you know, that love is synonymous with that intelligence. It's one and the same. And that's the fuel that drives us. And yeah, of course, we put it through our own filtration system, vis-a-vis our programming, our conditioning. And it's about really getting eyes for what that really means. So there was just something when you said that just really landed for me in a big way. Because this understanding is baked into all kinds of spiritual philosophy, and there it is in a very eloquent and beautiful way in the Bible. And I just, you know, I just continue to feel like, yeah, this is the direction I need to look in. This is what I need to develop rapport with. And know that this is the side on which my bread is buttered. And that's an incredible font of pure creative potential. And what a great word to summarize that pure creative potential. And that word is love.
Yeah. So Alvin, to help people put the dots together and to make sure that I'm understanding correctly, what I hear you saying is that these spiritual awakenings, the clarity that you experienced as a result of feeling that love experientially, knowing who you are in that experiential way, that was where the psychological healing came from. Am I putting that together? Yeah. Could you share a little bit more about how that connects to the healing on the psychological level?
Yeah, it connects in a very, very profound way, Angus Rohini. Because what I came to know, what I'm still coming to know, because it's always unfolding, right? Is that our health, our well-being is inherent. It's like you said, Angus, it's baked in. And that any thinking to the contrary is just that. It's just our thinking. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that's our story, our narrative. It's not truth.
Right. It's the narrative. It's the story. It's the noise. It's the distortion. And that maybe it's a part of the human experience, if you will. For me, when I read the story of the Garden of Eden, that's exactly what that's what I see, is that, you know, and I'm not saying that this happened literally or historically, but metaphorically or mythologically, that these two beings, Adam and Eve, if you will, being tempted by some external thing, this fruit, if you will, thinking or believing that they needed this additional thing in order to be like or to be connected to God, when the truth is or was, is that they already were that. And to think that there's anything external to the truth of who you are can, quote unquote, save you or enhance is the lie.
Right.
It's the distortion.
Yeah. And waking up to, and I know that we're all waking up to this. This is infinite, so there's no arrival here. But in that, what you've experienced, and being able to see that you have this innate well-being, and that it wasn't the events that happened to you in your life that were continuing to create suffering, although those were painful events, many of them, but that it was the narrative that was telling you you weren't lovable, that was telling you that you were separate, that was telling you that you weren't good enough, that was the cause of the suffering.
Right.
And then seeing the truth more deeply allowed you to not identify with that. I mean, this is how Angus and I would talk about it. And I just want to see, is that how you speak about it as well?
Being part of the human experience, part of the human dilemma, is that these things are a lot louder, and partly because we're so used to them. You know,
yeah.
We've lived with them for many, many years or decades. So it feels solid. It feels true. The mind wants to attach to and believe that, yes, I am unlovable because of whatever,
mm-hmm.
or that,
mm-hmm.
you know, God abandoned me or whatever that is for people. It can feel so fundamentally true because of our experience with it, our relationship with it over the years. And it's the awakening or awakenings, because again, it's continual and it's unfolding, that reorients us to the truth of who we really are. So that then we're better able to navigate the human experience.
Absolutely.
I was thinking, and you know, this is something that I often reflect on. But there's a quote, and I can't remember who originally came up with it. It's not so much a quote as a sort of an awareness of how things are. And I think I heard this from Sid Banks. I think I was listening to a recording of his one the other day, and I've mentioned this a couple of times in kind of in some of the groups that I've taught, is how there are many modalities in psychology that are out there that sort of work on a behavioral level, that work on the level of form, that work on the level of programming and conditioning, and that this term psychology in its essence breaks itself down to, I think it's Greek, and the root word is psyche, which means soul. And so psychology, logic of the soul, a study of the soul, I feel like, you know, when I was thinking about this earlier and this idea of developing rapport with that part of myself, it's sort of developing rapport with what we're pointing to, with what we really mean by psychology. And I think that everything that you're talking about is just, for me, yes, absolutely, fundamentally, that's where we heal. And it's so easy to look to the form, to look to the programming, conditioning, and try to figure all that out. But it's when we start looking in the direction of our soul, of that intelligence, and that field of infinite creative possibility, that's where the needle starts to shift into the into what is our innate mental health and well-being, obviously. And I guess I still kind of like, well, what does that exactly mean and how do I get there? But there's something around just being present to that, where that movement already starts to become realized. That feels to me like a fundamental truth, but so hard to put some kind of form on that. And I'm kind of loving the fact that we're all kind of looking in that direction. But a hard thing to articulate, nevertheless, is like, you know, how can we give some sort of concrete evidence that when we really find ourselves present to that field, to God, that's when the shift happens? Because we're so hung up on form, the form of our human experience.
Right. Yeah, you're so right, Angus. I mean, these things are very difficult to articulate or to put into to words, concepts. And again, for me, that's why music and art is so important, because then it can take you outside of the thinking so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reorient you to the heart space.
Yeah.
Because that's where the healing, that's where the health is. It's in the, yeah.
Yeah, and isn't it interesting also to sort of consider, and I've considered this myself, how, well, you might, well, let's, you know, look at the world of music, and then you might hear some melody, or might hear a tune, and then you hear lyrics put on that melody and that tune. And those lyrics might not necessarily fall into whatever standards and expectations we have about what's acceptable, you know, in terms of the right kind of vernacular to use or the right kind of words to use. But you're still resonating with that pure creative essence, which is God. That's what we're getting a taste of, and that's what we're feeling. And it's so, the words are always so clunky, but it's mm-hmm. the feeling that's behind them.
Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. It's the feeling, and it's what Sid would say as well, right?
Yeah,
it's the feeling tone, the emotion.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So this is what you've seen even before. You know, you came into the rewilding community and, you know, the teachings of Sydney Banks. And so I'm curious, how has that been impactful to you, given how much you'd already seen? And I know that it's all on the same page, but I'm wondering, what was there about rewilding that appealed to you?
Well, for me, rewilding is another way of talking about or being with the same essence. Talking mm-hmm. about the same things, because for me, rewilding helps me to—I'll say that word again—to reorient, to redirect me to live from my authenticity, from my heart, rather than staying stuck in my brain or staying stuck in my head. That's what rewilding is mm-hmm. for me. One of the things that it's done or doing is giving me the freedom to do exactly what we're doing here today and to be on this podcast with you and Angus, because, you know, just a few months ago, I wouldn't have given myself permission to feel okay enough to do this, because, you know, I'd be too nervous, and I'm nervous right now. I'm aware of it, but I'm not allowing it to, you know, to stop me. But I would tell myself all kinds of things, why I couldn't do this. I couldn't be heard or be seen because of my past experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. That conditioning can show up in all kinds of different ways. And I just want you to know that how you're showing up is just great. And I would never know that you were nervous.
No, not at all.
You're a cool cat.
Yeah.
It's the rewilding.
There's something that's coming up for me too, you know, this feels fresh around that term rewilding, because, you know, when we talk about music and apply it to music and what I was just talking about and the way that we might put words on a tune, and the tune is that pure creative essence, even the words that we might put on it can be part of that essence. But there's just something about just sort of a letting go and just seeing, you know, in its kind of wild and pure form. Yeah, sometimes those words can be clunky and sometimes even meaningless, and we can project our own meaning on them. But there's something about allowing ourselves to sort of like tap into what is unstoppable, uncappable, pure creative essence that just wants to flow out of us.
Yeah.
And music is just such a wonderful medium to sort of witness that take place. You know, you talked about when we were talking, you know, just briefly as we were getting ready to press record on this session, you were talking about, well, you know, what are we going to talk about? Well, let's let it be like a sort of jazz improv. And that's, you know, seems like how that's unfolding anyway, but it's kind of like that's what to me is wild. That's the way to do life, is just see what emerges out of that pure creative potential. And then, you know, hopefully we get to put a bit of form on it. Hopefully, you know, we get a moment where we kind of like get to sort of ride that form and experience it and kind of co-create with it. So for me, this term rewilding is in its essence, it's kind of like, let's go back to what is wild and unstoppable, and cannot be held back, and just hopefully ride a bit of that wave and see where it takes us.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with you more. For me, it feels like, the rewilding is we get to participate. We get to do this dance, with this intelligence, with this infinite wisdom and intelligence. We get to partner with and dance with this intelligence. because it's both, right? One, for me, one couldn't really happen without the other, because absent the human experience, there would be no music, for instance, or there'd be no books written, or art, or photography, or any of that. But like a jazz solo, or thinking back to music, because everything is music for me. Everything relates to music. That there's the period of learning the craft, if you will, learning the mechanics of music, notes and scales and music theory and modes and all of that stuff. And then you get to a place where you, I don't want to say you necessarily forget it, but you can free yourself from it. It's you're not so much thinking about it in your head so much. When you're on the bandstand, or when you're in a performance situation and you're having this conversation with other musicians on the stage, you get to participate in something that takes over. Ideally, hopefully, that's the moments that I live for as a musician, that in all of my years of practice and study, I then get to free myself from all of that and become the instrument. So that the music then, as in life is living me, it's living you, and it's living you, Rohini, and the music is being played through me.
I so love that visual, the metaphor of dancing with that intelligence. And you think about dance, I just had this vision of someone, you know, just sort of expressing themselves through the medium of dance. And it's like, this is what we're doing in this human experience. We're just expressing that intelligence. And the more that we open up to the flow of that, the more wonderful this life will be. And how wonderful that music is, just such an expressive art form in that respect. Is that you really are, you know, in the same way that you're talking about dancing with that intelligence, you're playing music with that intelligence. It's such a co-creative act. And to think of it, life is living me. I, you know, if I can understand that and be the observer of that, it will be a wild ride.
Absolutely. I have a question about that piece, Alvin, because after you were in Austin, you had those spiritual awakenings, but you went to Austin before you had them. I'd love to hear a little bit more about how that was for you, given your upbringing, given the conditioning around what was okay, what wasn't okay with music. What allowed you to do that? What helped you to do that? How were you able to leave Alabama and head over to Austin to become a musician? Or were you already a musician in Alabama?
A little bit. I was playing in church here, and mostly church music.
But it sounds like that was a big leap.
It was huge. Yeah. To leave everything known to me, to leave family and familiar environments, and to leave a very comfortable, cushy job, a well-paying job. I talk about all of this in the book as well. But there was something in me that was just, I was so unhappy and so unfulfilled. And I knew I had to leave. And it was scary. It was, up until that time, the scariest thing that I'd ever done, because I didn't know. Well, I had one friend in Austin, Texas at the time, but shortly after I moved, he got shipped out to Japan. So I didn't know anybody in Austin. But what happened was I started going out to the jazz clubs and some of the other music clubs. There was an area at the time, 6th Street, and anybody that spent any time in Austin knows about 6th Street, kind of like Beale Street in Memphis. And there was all these live music venues, nightclubs on both sides of the street for blocks. I'm on the back of my friend's motorcycle on a Saturday night. He takes me down to 6th Street, and I had never heard or seen anything like it in my life. And I said, oh my God, I've died and gone to heaven. There's just so much live music. I mean, reggae and R&B and blues and rock and roll. I said, this is it. So I started going to jam sessions and meeting other players. And I recognized then that, oh, if I'm going to play in this arena, I'm going to have to step up my game because, you know, I've been living in a small town in Alabama and just playing in church choirs. But now I'm meeting people that they're full-time musicians. They're touring and they're recording and they read music charts. And it's like, oh my God, if I'm going to play at this level, I've got to go home and woodshed. So that's exactly what I did. And, you know, some amount of time, a few months, a year or so, started getting gigs. And it just all started from there. Now, I will say at the same time, it was still a struggle for me spiritually and mentally, because in the back of my mind, I was still asking myself, what if my parents are right? You know, what if the ministers at my church are right, that playing this music is going to sentence me to hell? I was enjoying myself, but I wasn't free in myself. It felt like I was dragging this 500-pound boulder behind me, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine that was quite a tension to be following your inner calling, yet not be sure if that meant you're going to go to hell. I mean, that's a big deal.
Oh, my God. Right?
Talk about competing intentions there.
Exactly. Really, me going to Austin, Texas was me going into the world in a manner of speaking, you know, the world, the flesh and the devil kind of thing. And I completely immersed myself in that world. But one of the things I discovered in being in the midst of that is that it wasn't nearly as bad as it had been made out to be, because I met some of the most beautiful people that I've ever met. I've got lifelong friends as a result of living in Austin.
And you became a professional musician at that point.
And I became a professional musician.
It's kind of like the call of the wild. You were led there by your intuition.
Call of the wild, the answering the call to adventure. It's you know, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table going into the forest and
forging. The hero's journey begins.
The hero journey begins. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I love that. And I so understand, and I you know, I mean, I know there's a spectrum to this, but certainly for me, I would go to church with my mum as a kid, and you know, the Anglican Church in the UK. And I came away from that experience, I don't know how much of a hold it had on me, but I know that it had a significant hold in the sense that, well, I better keep believing, even though I can't really kind of put satisfactory words on what those beliefs are for me at a core level, in case when I get to those pearly gates, I'm going to be sent in the wrong direction. It's like it was my insurance plan.
I was going to say, that's like your insurance card, right?
Exactly. So I kind of felt like I lived a good portion of my life thinking on those terms. And that's there's my programming conditioning in terms of my spirituality for a long time until I started to see it differently. So it's funny how we take on those points of view. And that was definitely my insurance card for many years. But I love the fact that, you know, that you would go to Austin and have an experience like that, and then sort of, you know, that's a sort of, it's a blossoming, it's an emergence, isn't it? It's a way of seeing things through a different lens.
You know, Angus, I can't know this for sure. It's just conjecture on my part, but a part of me suspects that in me deciding to answer the call to move to Austin, maybe in a way that's what opened up or allowed the spiritual experiences to start happening. Because one of the messages that I got out of all of that was that I came away knowing that I had been given a gift from God, if you will, both my passion for music as well as my passion and love for the teachings of the scriptures, the teachings of Jesus and the Gita and all of this, that they weren't divergent paths, which I had been led to believe. This is exactly what I believe. It was one or the other. You served God or you served the devil, but not both. But one thing that came out of these spiritual awakenings was that, no, Alvin, it's all one and the same. I've given you both. And this is how, if you choose, this is how I can use you. This is how you can serve in the world.
It's funny how that's kind of like in the small print of a lot of religious dogma. It's kind of like, yeah, you know what? If you go else looking elsewhere, you're gonna burn in hell.
That's right. That's right. That's the controlling aspect, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And that I don't think, maybe, I don't think that I would have come to that knowing had I not gone to Austin. Meaning, for instance, if I'd stayed in the fundamentalist Christian church, I never would have come to that.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't have been the space for that.
Yeah. It is so interesting how we kind of, you know, and this is something that I've been reflecting on a lot of late, and I guess in some of my readings and some of my explorations, it's kind of like if you think about the intelligence behind life and its relationship with the human condition, and that intelligence is doing life, it's basically, that's the divine orchestration of life, that life is always looking to grow and evolve and expand. So we're always going to be moving forward. We're always going to be looking for a different experience. So isn't it? It kind of makes sense. It's like, yeah, you grew up in Alabama. I want a different experience. I want to grow and evolve and learn. And you're led by your interests and your passions. But that's kind of like, it feels like that's the course and the thrust of this intelligence. It's always looking to evolve and expand and grow. And yet we are so inclined to sort of like, want to sort of like, put form on it and then like package it and brand it and keep it still in one place.
That's right.
And that's generally where I think as human beings we suffer. We're going to get kind of caught up. We kind of imprison ourselves in that structure. When that structure, there was, you know, the intelligence was always looking for the fluidity of the experience rather than put yourself in a box, pigeonhole yourself in a way.
Mm-hmm. So right. And I think that a lot of times that's where the traditions come from, if you will. The traditions can be good as a grounding, if you will, but at the same time, they can imprison us, they can trap us, that we can get stuck in the old ways and the old beliefs, and that nothing can change, nothing can ever expand or shift, because it's seen as a departing from the truth, whereas I sense that it's more like what you're saying, that the nature of life, the nature of this intelligence is that it's ever expanding, expansive, evolving, and that it's wanting to use us. We're being a part of it as humans. We're the ones that get to it. It's as if God gets to live through us as us in our playing, so that God gets to play in our human experience, in our human endeavors.
It's like we're the paintbrushes painting the canvas. Mm. Yeah.
That's lovely.
Because short of the human experience, God's just sitting on a bliss cloud, right?
Right. Yeah.
Need some drama. Let's have some humans give me some drama.
And what are we doing here if not to grow and learn? You know, that's how I see it.
Yeah.
And play.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just, again, that reminder for everyone who's listening that they're, we're not separate. There is this intelligence that's living us, and that when we listen, it's the listening that allows us to break free from the conditioning and to break free from our limiting beliefs and to feel resourced by that beautiful feeling. And in the listening to that, there's a lot of common sense and information that guides us in terms of what's next and how to sort of attune to that so that we can take those next steps. And sometimes in small ways, sometimes in big ways. It sounds like you made some big leaps based on your listening.
Yeah, moving clear across the country, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And so in terms of your book, and I know that it might sort of be open-ended at this point in time, but do you have a sense of when that might be available?
I'm thinking the first part of next year.
Okay,
February,
so soon.
March. Yeah, pretty soon. As a matter of fact, I'm looking to put up a website here within the coming weeks.
Oh, well, you have to make sure we have the link.
For sure.
When this gets shared. Mm-hmm. And then I remember you talking about having sort of an experience with the book that's not just about publishing a book, but very much including your music. So I'd love to hear more about what you envision as how you're going to share what you've seen with the world, whether it's through the book or in that bigger picture.
Yeah, what I'm envisioning, Rohini, and what I'd like is that this would be a marriage of music as well as, you know, sharing the book as well as public speaking, that it's a combination of all of that. What I'm seeing is that it's not just about getting more information or data, mm-hmm. if you will, but it's actually embodying these ideas, these teachings through music and through dance and movement. Yeah.
That sounds wonderful.
That's fantastic.
It definitely is aligned with rewilding, so we hope to be invited.
Angus, Rohini, you guys are VIP front row.
Yeah.
Well, we can't wait. Yeah, I just really appreciate your commitment to being of service and to sharing from your lived experience and the vast range of your lived experience to be able to point people to how they can experience more of who they are and to experience the healing of that and the credibility from which you share that based on what you've overcome, what you've learned from, what has been part of your journey, I think is very profound. And it's a message I think that will resonate and help so many people.
Yeah. And, you know, as I said earlier, it's continual unfolding, if mm-hmm. you will. But what I know without a doubt is that from what I've experienced, what I've tasted and what I've seen, I can't unsee. And that if somebody like me can be born in prison, that's my first experience as a physical being. I can't think of anything that would be more traumatic than that being your first experience, because, and I'm not trying to make any sort of hierarchy around mm-hmm. trauma, because mm-hmm. it's all terrible. But that, for me, other kinds of trauma tends to be, it happens at a later point in life, that you have a reference point, you have a memory of not having had that experience, whatever happened to you. You remember you before the event happened. In my case, that's my very first experience. So there is no other reference point. So with that, to then come to this space, this expanse, where I know who I am, and that nothing's ever happened to me, and that this wisdom, this love, this intelligence orchestrated even that. And I'll share about this in the book as well, that, you know, for the first 10 months of my life, I had no idea where I was. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But this wisdom did. And this wisdom loved me and protected me and guided me to the family that would raise me, and that would raise me in the environment and the foundation that would give me a passion and love for spiritual things. That can't be coincidental. And it's not random, and it's not accidental. So what I want to share, hopefully, in this book and in my music and in my talks, that you can trust this. You can trust this. You can surrender to this. Because this wisdom, this intelligence is love. It is love, and it loves you more than you can ever, ever put into words.
Yeah.
The music gets close.
Mm.
Yeah. And isn't that what we're all looking to experience? Just that deeper knowing of the truth of that. That deeper layer of recognition that we can surrender into that space within ourselves. And it's not separate from us. It is us. And we don't need anyone or anything to access it. We all have an equal accessibility, and that there's no hierarchy there. No one is above us, below us. It's just right there. And the question is, what's our readiness to look in that direction? And I know I've only seen a glimpse, and like you're saying, it's just unfolding, but that's enough for me to know the direction that I want to do my best to keep looking in.
just to be completely transparent, I often find myself thinking this, and I'm sure I've spent some time, a little bit of time in this conversation, just reflecting on, like, how do you harness, how do you grab a hold of it?
How do you bottle that up?
And really, you know, you can't. I mean, I don't know. You can never say never. But I mean,
formless.
I think the best that we can do is tell a story. And you've got an amazing story to tell, obviously. I mean, how could it not be amazing for everything that you've just shared? And that sort of helps us adjust our compass point. That helps other people to adjust their compass point and start looking in a better direction. And I think that's the best that we can do, or the best that I can see at this point in my life. Yeah, sure, I'd like to feel like, how do I bottle this up? But it seems like that's a pretty fruitless endeavor in my experience. but we do have these moments where we just like fall into it. And then it's frustrating because like, oh, I've fallen into it. How do I bottle it up for future reference?
I mustn't lose it now.
I need to quickly write down these coordinates.
That's right. It's slipping through my hands.
It is.
That's the dance of it.
It is the dance of it.
And as I always say, Inga says this is my repetitive statement, is that all of it is that intelligence. It's not just the beautiful feeling. Yes, that is it. But the entire human experience is an expression of that life force. And we may have our preferences about what we like and what we don't like about the human experience, but I see it as all being for us and all part of that growth and expansion and learning, and that we can't really see more of who we are without having some of those growing pains along the way.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. That's the way I tend to see it, right?
Yeah. I think, I mean, ultimately, we come from love. We're made up of love. We are love. And it's just a case of us just hopefully doing our best to remember that. And hopefully people like you cajole us into doing that with your story.
Absolutely. You're helping rewild us back to love as we sit here listening to you share.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, guys. It's certainly my heart's desire. It's certainly my intention. And I believe that's the power, part of the power of storytelling.
Yeah,
absolutely.
What an amazing pointer.
Yeah. Well, Alvin, thank you so much for allowing us to get a sneak preview of your book. And we wish you every success and really look forward to reading it when it's ready. And I'm sure we'll, if you're open to it, if you're not too busy, love to have you back on once it's out there in the world.
I'd love to.
Incredible. Thank you so much, Alvin.
Yeah. Oh, and thank you, Angus and Rohini. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much for inviting me to share with you today, and for all of your help and for the Rewilding program, because it's making a huge difference. Mm. You need to know that.
Oh, thank you. We'd love to hear that.
Yes.
Thank you so much for listening to Rewilding Love. If you enjoyed this podcast, please let us know by subscribing on iTunes, and we would love for you to leave a review there.
iTunes reviews will steer people to this podcast who need help with their relationships.
If you would like to learn more about our work and our online Rewilding community, please visit our website, therewilders.org.
Thanks for listening. Join us next week.